On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Linksys and Netgear get backdoored, Christmas saved the surface, and we talk all about our 2014 predictions. Twight on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 74, recorded January 3rd for January 6th, 2014. The 2014 predictions. Loser buys the pizza. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. And welcome to 2014. Okay, we need to put some post-process cheers and confetti. Okay, we'll work on that. I'm Father Robert Ballister, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. Thank you for the golf clap. But of course, I'm not alone. I'm joined by my great cast of conspirators, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the Father Time, or are you the New Year's baby of the Geek in Tech?
Oh, who knows? All I know is that I have a bouncing baby cold and I'm trying to kill it. And I'm kind of feeling weird.
Yeah, I got a little bit of that. I'm not sure if I got it from the New Year celebration or if I'm just tired. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency, are you feeling a little bit under the weather?
Not under the weather, feeling sad about the weather here in Florida because it's cold. Only made it up to about 48 degrees here in North Florida. And for us, that is a veritable ice age. But warmer and sunnier days are ahead. So far, we're going to call 2014 a great year.
Well, gentlemen, congratulations on making it to yet another year of Twyatt. As I mentioned at the last episode of 2013, it is always a pleasure to be with you, and we've got something interesting planned for the Twyatt Riot. We want to talk all about our predictions for 2014. Now, it's a little bit of a different kind of a prediction show because enterprise is not regular tech. We all know enterprise lives kind of in a realm of its own. So we're going to get to what we think we're going to see in the short term, in the midterm, meaning before the end of the year, and in the long term of our enterprise world. And then next year, for 2015, we'll be bringing it back and find out how close we were. But before that, there are a few enterprise bites that I want to hit. This first one is actually a little bit scary. We have a story here from Ars Technica, how a user by the name of Eloy Vanderbeeken found a vulnerability in Netgear and Linksys routers. Now, these are the DSL / router / wireless combinations that you see when you buy service from your major ISP. He scanned ports on his family's WAG200G, which is a Linksys combination device, and found it responding to port 32764, which is strange because normally nothing lives at port 32764. Now, he also found, by searching on the internet, that other products from Netgear and Linksys responded to that very same port. And so it got him thinking, what's going on there? What services are living beneath that 3276? He then downloaded the Linksys firmware, reverse engineered it, and found an interface listening there that allowed him to send commands to the router without the need to authenticate as an administrator. Now, off the bat, let me drop this over to you, Chibert. How bad is it that there is an undocumented listening port that furthermore allows people to just send commands that are automatically executed without any sort of authentication whatsoever?
Oh, man, this is a security nightmare. The worst part is you know, you got to keep in mind, I don't think these guys write the base code, so the operating system for this thing. I have a feeling that we've got someone that made a mistake and left a diagnostic port or something like that open in this particular rev. And I think that's what we're going to find out when someone finally fesses up to what happened.
Right. Yeah, that strikes me that this is probably something that was left in there during the testing phase, maybe a way for people to use a like an app to get into the router and configure it. Maybe something that's left there for the technician who's actually diagnosing a modem from within. Because an addendum to the story is that this is not a port that is accessible from the outside world. So I couldn't just start hitting people's internet connection, their WAN connection, and try to get in. I'd actually have to be on the inside of their network. But it still is a little disconcerting because, Curtis, we've seen these sorts of exploits used before. They can only be reached from the inside, but what happens is any compromised computer inside the network can then start hammering on that port from inside the network, right?
That's right. It's those horizontal vulnerabilities that start to become more and more important when you have vulnerabilities like this. As you say, all it takes is one badly compromised machine inside the firewall, and the entire network is at risk, especially when you have things like this. And again, I'm sure the Netgear is going to be saying, hey, you can only get at it from inside. It's not a big deal. That's true as long as you're sure that inside is secure. And we've passed the point at which you can assume that inside your network is secure. These days, you have to assume that attacks, that exploits, that vulnerabilities are going to come from 360 degrees.
T-Bert, I was just thinking we should probably do a segment on using Nmap, right, which is a nice free program that you can set to hammer all the IP range inside your local network and just listen for any services that might be open. That sounds like something that people should get used to doing, not just trusting that the manufacturer is going to patch up a vulnerability.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I actually run – there's two things that I run on a regular basis. I have the tool on my iPad and also on my Android. When I'm just sitting there listening to someone natter on in a long-winded meeting, I'll just go and scan their Wi-Fi network that they've let me onto and find out what's open. And then also I do a SNMP check to see who's left public and private open.
Okay, sorry. Right there, it almost made me full stop. So what you're saying is if someone invites you to a meeting and gets you bored, you're probably going to break their security.
Did I say that?
All right, let's go back over to you, Curtis, because I don't want to get T-Bert into too much trouble. One last bit about this. The reason why we're so concerned about this on the enterprise level, even though this is about consumer-level hardware, right? This is Linksys, this is Belkin. Typically, we wouldn't say, well, this is a problem for the enterprise. It's a problem because of BYOD, right? Because of VPNs, because people can get in through their home networks, because people can bring back infected devices, plug them into the enterprise network, and then suddenly what looked like a consumer vulnerability is now an enterprise-wide vulnerability.
Oh, absolutely. You know, at a certain level with BYOD, anything that happens at the employee's house can happen inside your enterprise network. They're going to bring stuff from their teenage kids back to the enterprise. They're going to bring stuff from their own vulnerabilities. And there are even issues with the remote workers. You know, it doesn't have to be stuff that they're doing on their own time. These days, many, many companies allow remote working from the storm that we're getting up in the Northeast today is a great example. I know of a lot of companies that told their employees, hey, don't come in, work from home. And that means that they're working from whatever home environment they've got. Now, all of a sudden, that home environment is part of the enterprise network. These vulnerabilities aren't just problems for people who are trying to get to their Netflix queue or to their Facebook page. These are now serious enterprise-level vulnerabilities and have to be treated that way.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Now, gentlemen, I want to move on to the next enterprise bite. I'm going to try an experiment here. This could completely backfire on me, but one at a time, I'm going to start with you, T-Bert. If I say Microsoft Surface, give me the first word that you associate with that. Anytime. You're muted. No, you're still
of
muted.
Course. Yeah, no, I'm not now. Like, no, experiment.
Experiment, okay. Curtis, same to you. Microsoft Surface.
Consumer,
okay. So we've got experiment and consumer, and that's great because we've got a story here from Wired that talks about how this Microsoft Surface experiment may just have been saved by Christmas. That's right. A big consumer holiday may have breathed a little bit of life into a platform that many were worried about maybe fading out of existence. We've got a story here from Wired talking about how Chitika, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. They're an online advertiser, found that Microsoft's tablet share in traffic was boosted up to 2.3% from 4% not too long ago. This was their Christmas boost. In other words, they're saying that people received a lot of Microsoft Surface tablets. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot. Even at 2.3%, that's a minuscule piece. But that boost puts Microsoft ahead of Google-created tablets. Not all Android tablets, just those created by Google. It also puts them below Amazon, which was about 9% of tablet traffic, below Samsung, which was about 23.7% of traffic, and iPads, which were 54.3% of traffic, but down 1.3% this holiday season, a season that they normally go up in. Let me throw this over to you, Brian. Do we take anything out of this? I mean, every time I hear one of these stories, it almost sounds as if someone's desperately trying to make a story out of something that could easily just be a statistical anomaly.
You know, I bought my Surface because I wanted Office. And the long and short of it is, I'm sorry, Office is the standard for the modern workplace. And without having that capability, it starts making a tablet a compromise. So while Microsoft did the right thing and put Office there, they need to go a little further. This whole thing with not being able to find apps is always going to be the Surface Achilles heel. But the fact that Office is available for those tablets is telling the industry that people really do want the productivity there. And I think that's the bottom line for Microsoft. It's the productivity that people want in the tablet.
Curtis, let's get a takeaway from you about this. I mean, I don't want to talk too much about this. We've talked ad nauseum about the Surface and about how, you know, it wasn't the savior of Microsoft that a lot of people thought it might be, that it was probably most responsible for Ballmer's departure from Microsoft. Is there, as T-Bert said, is there a way for Microsoft to rejigger this thing, to make it a more compelling product, to make it that bridge between Microsoft's enterprise-class solutions and their consumer-class solutions? Or is this just a little blip that's going to go away eventually?
Well, to me, there are two takeaways here. One is that we shouldn't read too much into one season. Yes, there was a blip, but, you know, in the consumer world, we do see things bob up and down based on a bunch of factors. One of those factors does deal with the question that you ask, and that's how Microsoft can make this more attractive. Something that we saw at Microsoft TechEd, where they offered attendees a Surface and a Surface Pro, each at a remarkably low price, was huge lines. I mean, lines that lasted hours to get these machines at, I think it was $99 for the Surface and $299 or $399 for the Surface Pro. There is a point at which people do see the value of the device matching the price that they're charging, and I suspect that there was some discounting going on. The problem for Microsoft is if the consumer sets that perceived value at a price point that Microsoft can't sustain. Now, they do have the Amazon option. A lot of people acknowledge that with the Kindles, especially the higher-end ones, there's no way that Amazon's making any real money. But they have figured out that when people buy a Kindle, they spend more money at Amazon. They're really willing to have that be a loss leader. If Microsoft is willing to do the same thing with the Surface, then they'll hit a low price, the value proposition changes, and at that point, it could indeed become a major power in the industry.
I like that. I like that prediction, but we're going to save that because we do want to talk about our predictions for the enterprise in 2014. To start off this segment, I want to bring us to a little story that I found at Wired. To step back in time, it was 58 years ago that IBM released their first computer hard drive. We got a picture here called Ramac. Now, Brian, Curtis, did you guys ever play with one of these things?
No, I don't go quite that far back, but I do remember the pizza ovens.
Yep, I had one of those, the pizza oven. How about you, Curtis? Did you ever have to play with one of these in one of these room-sized hard drives?
You know, I was around those. By the time I was using hard drives, they were down to washing machine size rather than room size. But I actually know quite a number of IBM techs who stayed at IBM a long time because they had expertise on these things. And it's amazing how long some major enterprises kept using these, even after the size had shrunk for new hard disks.
Absolutely. Now, a few things about this device. It had 50 platters, 50 steel platters that would spin at 1,200 revolutions per minute. It was painted, literally painted with a magnetic coating that allowed it to store a magnetic state. You know, hard drive, that's how hard drives work. And with all this technology, which was the size of a room, not just those spindles, but all the control panels that you saw, it stored a whopping huge, I mean, just mind-boggling 5 megabytes of data. And it could transfer that data at a blazing fast 100 kilobits per second. I mean, this USB mouse transfers data faster than that now. Now, I bring this up because this device, which came up 58 years ago, and we can laugh at now, did form the basis for a brand new revolution in storage, magnetic devices, and therefore the computer industry as we know it. So now I want to break it out to you. What are our predictions for 2014? Well, I want to set the ground rules. We're going to be talking about a short term, which is in the next 6 months, a medium term, which is before the end of the year, and a long-term prediction. And I'm going to kick it off because, well, I think that's fair game. My short-term prediction is this. I think with everything that's been happening with the NSA, with everything that's been happening with the DOJ, with all the rulings that have come down about the Computer Security Act, about what is and is not private when you store it in a public cloud, I think the public cloud is going to bleed enterprise users. I think in the next 6 months, you're going to see this rush to this to the private cloud, to colos that are actually on location, to cages that are actually owned by corporations. I think they're going to be so gun shy by what's gone on, by the fact that their data has been monitored, by the fact that their data seems to be so vulnerable, that they're going to speed up this movement of all services to something that they actually own rather than something they share with other companies. Let me throw this over to you, Chi, but first, am I off here? I mean, do you think 6 weeks is a decent time, 6 months is a decent time frame to say enterprises are going to rush to the private cloud?
No, I think that's dead on, spot on, and totally accurate. I'm already starting to see it. The University of Hawaii is actually opening up their own private cloud. There's an awful lot of researchers that are really, really worried about their proprietary information getting leaked to the wrong types of people. I'm definitely already starting to see people move into private clouds, and I'd love to see some sales numbers from Rackspace, because I'll bet you they are hemorrhaging customers.
What about you, Curtis? Do you see this? I do want to get all sides here. Is there any scenario under which you see enterprise, at least enterprise that can afford it, not moving their private data away from a public cloud?
Well, I think it depends on how you define public cloud. I do think that people are going to be, and already are, looking hard at their relationships with companies like Google and Amazon. Those have become great, huge targets. What we are seeing, though, is a lot of companies that do look, you know, Chebert mentioned Rackspace. I'm not sure that Rackspace is going to bleed all that badly. But I do think that what they do lose will at least partially be absorbed by companies like IBM, HP, Dell, and their related service organizations, because each of these is pushing cloud offerings hard and trying to say that with their cloud offerings, you're getting private level security and privacy without the expense of on-premise hardware. And believe me, having tasted the savings that come with hosted solutions, a lot of enterprises are going to have to see more risk than they've seen so far from the NSA to go back to a fully on-premise solution. Hybrids are going to be huge. There's going to be movement, but the cat's out of the bag. CTOs and CFOs love the idea of paying rent on storage rather than buying it.
Yep. Yeah, it always looks better on the bottom line. Chiebert, I want to throw back to you because I could almost hear you thinking this in the last segment. Because when we talk about private and public cloud, when we talk about the hybridization of where we keep our storage and our services, there's actually multiple types of public cloud, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, when we start thinking public cloud, we always start thinking about Amazon, Google, and so forth, where you are renting just resources. You know, you don't know what it's stored on. You don't know what your computing platform is. It's just very, very cloudy. What I'm looking at is that because of, shall we say, a lack of assurances or a whole bunch of nervousness on the management in a lot of organizations, you're going to start seeing people going away from what I call the fully cloudy solution to a partially cloudy solution where you're buying resource pools, but you control those resources. So in the VM world, you have X number of virtual CPUs, X number of virtual NICs, X number of virtual switches, and X gig terabytes or whatever virtual storage. But you own that, you control it. So you've got a lot more chance of making sure that you don't have, bad things happening to you. But when someone else controls all the infrastructure where you have less control, I think that's the portion that's going to hemorrhage. So they're either going to pull into fully private clouds where it's on their premise, or they're going to pull back into their resources so that it's a publicly hosted private cloud, so the hybrid cloud.
All right, gentlemen, this is a moment of truth. We're going to vote now so that we know forevermore what we thought about this prediction. Of course, I'm going to say yay. I'm going to say yes, we're going to see a rush from public to private cloud. Chiebert?
I say we're going to see a rush from public cloud to hybrid clouds.
Okay, public to hybrid. And Curtis?
I think I'm going to agree with Chiebert. Public to private is one of those things where the costs just get in the way. Hybrid is where we're going to see a lot of companies going.
All right, so I'm alone thinking that we're moving into entirely the closed cloud. We are, in fact, according to our other two hosts, going to move to some sort of hybrid. And, of course, they're going to be right because they're a lot smarter than me. But let's talk about that. Chiebert, you've got a short-term pick here. Tell me about it. And you're muted.
Yes, of course. I am muted. Oh, hold on. Where is it? Okay, short-term. I'm going to predict that we're going to start seeing a lot more people finally taking advantage of back-end processing. The model that's like Google Translate or Google Glass, where the device that provides your connection into the cloud is relatively lightweight. So the Google Chrome, an Android tablet, and so forth. But it formats the query so that the back-end can go and chew away at it. I'm going to start seeing, things like... Microsoft's demonstration was absolutely staggering, where the speaker would be speaking in English. It would talk to a very large back-end system, not only translate from English to Mandarin, but it also took his inflections. As the toolkits start becoming more and more available and easier to use and less confusing, we're going to start seeing a lot more people putting the back-end processing so you can do really, really spectacular things with relatively lightweight devices.
Curtis, what do you think about that? This sounds like the old mainframe idea where the device you hold does very little. All it does is display, and all the processing, all the muscle is away. It's a corner that you don't see.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. This is a return to the mainframe model. I've said before, I think that it's amazing that it's taken us 50 years, and basically what we've done is reinvent the mainframe.
Yeah, isn't that strange how we've come around circle like that? Chiebert, I like it. I think your prediction is spot on. I think, yeah, we're going to see more of this, or we already are. I mean, when you talk to devices like Siri or when you talk to Google Now, it looks like it's happening on that device, but the main processing is actually being done in a server farm in some nondescript place. So let's do a quick vote on that one. Do we think that more processing is going to be done in the background, mimicking the old mainframe style? I'm absolutely yay. I'm all for that. Chiebert?
Yay.
Yay. And Curtis?
Big thumbs up.
We're all thumbs up. And now that guarantees we're going to be wrong because we didn't have a dissenting voice. What did they call that in World War Z? The 12th man or the devil's advocate? Something like that. I don't know. All right. But, Cheever, you had one more short-term prediction. Hit it.
Okay. Security problems. We're all – this whole thing with Snowden, the NSA monitoring, everybody's going crazy about security. But I think we're finally going to start seeing things like Google Authenticator start getting some traction. People are finally learning what multi-factor authentication is. We're starting to see it happening definitely on Facebook with their code generator. I think this is going to be the next two quarters of multi-factor authentication.
Okay. I'm going to take the line here that this is a hard push. So this is a short term. So within the next 6 months, I believe that multi-factor authentication is important. I don't think we're yet at the point that they're willing to invest the training dollars and the resources it will take to make people use two-factor authentication. What about you, Curtis? You're muted.
I think that what we're going to see is a lot of companies and a lot of analysts watching one piece of hardware, and that is the iPhone 5S. They're going to be looking and trying to figure out the usage patterns on that. I think in the next 6 months, we'll start to see companies do their analysis and come back and start to tell us whether or not consumers are using multi-factor authentication. If we're seeing consumers embrace it, then I believe that within 6 months, we may start to see companies moving in the direction of multi-factor authentication. If the word comes back that customers are absolutely ignoring the fingerprint scan as something that they're using in multi-factor authentication, then I think that this one gets pushed out a lot further.
Now, I'm not going to let you get away with that, that maybe if the iPhone gets away. Cheebert, okay, for you, will we see multi-factor authentication get a large rollout in the next 6 months? Yay or nay?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Especially because of Microsoft and Facebook.
Okay, Microsoft and Facebook will drive it. Yes, indeed, in 6 months. I'm going to say no. I'm going to say it will happen eventually. Definitely not in the next 6 months. Curtis, over to you.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to agree with you on this one, Padre. I think that ultimately we'll get multi-factor authentication, but barring some sort of absolute disaster in the next 6 weeks, I don't think there's going to be that big a move in the next 6 months.
I love it. Okay, good. I like dissent. Dissent is good because it means that come around 2015, we're going to have some fun. By the way, the loser buys pizza. We all eat pizza, right?
Yeah,
pizza sounds good.
Loser buys pizza. Okay. Let's go over to you, Curtis. You've got an interesting short-term pick. You want to break it down for us?
Yeah, unfortunately, both of my short-term picks are bad news. The first is that sometime in the next 6 months, I think we're going to see a major healthcare organization get hacked in a way that releases significantly private data, up to and including genetic data for a fairly significant number of patients. That's going to be huge. You know, we've had things like numbers released for people, but we haven't really had something as personal as genetic information and their diagnoses, things like that released. We're getting there. And I think that within the next 6 months, we're going to see the first one where it's public and it's out there.
Okay, Cheever, what about this? So 6 month time frame. So we're talking about something that has to already be in operation. I mean, if this is a big attack, it's something that's already been running. This actually plays into one of my predictions, so I'm just going to use it here. If it's going to be within the next 6 months, it means that an advanced persistent threat must have already been running at the time of this broadcast that will wipe out a major healthcare organization. I said it was going to be a devastating advanced threat. What do you think? 6 months, is that enough time? Is it in process? Are we going to see it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I agree with Curtis. This is not something we want to predict, but I think it's going to happen. Especially considering how many doctors I work with and how cavalier they are about, antivirus and anti-spyware and so forth on their personal laptops, and how the doctors are pushing the IT groups of healthcare to let them in from anywhere. And, you know, doctors have been the ones that are complaining the biggest about multi-factor authentication. And they, hospitals were some of the first places to get rid of the secure ID because the doctors hated it. I'm not sure it's going to be a huge spill. I think it's going to be more of a medium-sized spill, especially because a lot of those genetic information systems and so forth are air-gapped from the full internet. But I think we are going to see some patient information spilled within the next 6 months, and I think it's going to be one heck of a wake-up call, and I think, unfortunately, President Obama is going to get involved, and it's going to get really messy.
All right, so let's set the ground rules here. Can we say if it's going to be a breach within the next 6 months, it has to be a reported breach? It can't be a rumor breach. It can't be, well, we heard about this breach a year ago. It's going to be within the next months, we're going to hear a story that's confirmed that says they lost X million patient records. Can we agree on that?
Yeah.
I can go with that.
Okay, so Curtis, your vote, yay or nay on this? Six months?
It's my prediction. I'd be kind of silly if I didn't say yes.
I wanted to give you the option. You know, okay, so you're a thumbs up. Chibert, thumbs up, thumbs down?
Yeah, definitely. It's going to happen.
I'm going to be the naysayer. I'm going to say thumbs down. I'm going to say we're going to see it. Absolutely. I think it's going to happen. I don't think in the next 6 months. I think maybe a year, maybe 2 years. But we'll see. So, Chibert, record it. Write it down. You've got one more short-term prediction, and dang it, Curtis, it's also nasty. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I wish I could be more optimistic for the first half of the year. Here's one where I think that in the same way that enterprises are using big data, the bad guys are too. And so sometime, and I think it's going to be in the next 6 months, we're going to see a release of personal information, and the first response is going to be, where on earth did it come from? The answer is going to be that it was put together out of publicly available data by criminals using big data techniques. We're going to see the first big data-driven vulnerability. And I think that while it might or might not include something like credit card numbers, it's going to have enough information to allow for identity theft. It's going to have enough information to allow for major access to personal data, and it's all going to come from publicly available data that was crunched by a criminal big data network.
Oh, okay. I really like this one. I should have taken this one. Chibert, over to you. So someone's going to figure out how to use publicly accessible data sets to do something bad. I think that's the prediction. What do you think?
Pretty much. I'm totally in agreement. As part of one of the briefings that I've had when we started talking about classified information and our friends in mainland China, there's a description saying that the bad guys are very patient. They will collect grains of sand, which we cast off carelessly. But if you're patient and you do it long enough, you collect enough grains of sand, pretty soon you have an entire beach.
Yeah.
I think that's what's going to start happening. Big data is going to allow us to vacuum up these little grains of sand and construct a beach much quicker than we all thought it would happen.
Yeah. Some of the guys in the chat room are right on this. I mean, they're saying, well, hasn't this already happened? To certain extents, our data has been used for this and for that. But I think the ground rules for this, and maybe my co-host can confirm this, the ground rules have to be it's going to be an earth-shocking discovery. It's going to be one of these things where people are freaked out. They actually reverse course on the amount of public data they release because someone figures out a way to use their public accessible data to do something really, really wrong. Can we agree on that?
Yeah, I've actually gotten to the point where I lie on a lot of my data that I put into survey forms.
I totally lie.
I
lie on everything.
Let me say, I think it's going to be one of two things. It's either going to be notable because of the size of the breach, or it's going to be notable because of the individuals. Imagine what would happen if it were, for example, legislators, Congress people, high government officials, or if it were celebrities, people in the public eye. I think it's going to be one of those two, either sheer quantity or high-level, very public, specific individuals who are hacked in this way.
All right, so here it is. Thumbs up, thumbs down. 6 months. It's going to be notable either because of the amount of data or because of the person or entity that collected it. Within 6 months, we're going to see some use of big data that is just shockingly horrible. And I'm gonna give it a thumbs up. I'd say 6 months, absolutely. That's a doable time frame. Gbert?
Ooh, I don't know. This is a tough one. Yeah, I'm going to say thumbs up.
Okay,
very
thumbs up.
Possible.
And Curtis, you give yours your prediction a thumbs up. Wow, three thumbs up. Okay, we are naysayers. We think the world's going to end. We're just negative people. We really are. Wow. All right, so that's our short-term predictions. That's within the next 6 months. Let's move on to our midterm predictions. And I want to start with you, Chibert, because you've got one that's not doom and gloom. Thank God.
That's okay, you. So medium term. I'm a maker. I love being a maker. I think makers are going to be the people that are going to drive the Internet of Things. You know, I'm building things like internet-connected sound pressure meters so we can find out what's going on, you know, how loud it is and what key and place like that. So I'm predicting makers are going to be putting out enough internet-connected things that the big manufacturers like LG and, you know, Kenmore and, you know, all these other people are going to say, oh, my God, there's actually a market. We better catch up.
Mm-hmm. I like this. Okay, so your prediction is that within the next, this is medium term, so within the next year, the maker movement is going to go to the point that the interesting little tidbit that people make and pass on from bot to bot to bot or from community to community to community is actually going to force the retail market to change their game. Did I read you right?
You got it.
Okay, Curtis, what do you think about that? Is there enough gas in the maker tank to change the way they do business because of the fear of losing out on those sales?
I think that it may well be. I think it's going to be limited. I don't think it's going to be something where there's wholesale change in any of these areas. But I think we are going to start to see a response. I mean, in a certain way, we already have. And I'll tell you, the company that has really shifted more than any other to respond to the maker world, and that is Radio Shack. If you looked at Radio Shack from 3 years ago, they were doing their best to become just another cell phone provider. I mean, they had cell phones, they had cable or satellite television systems in there. They were lost. Now look at them. They have gone back and embraced the maker community. They have kits of things. They are eating this up. They won't be the last. Will we see companies like, you know, Chibert mentioned Samsung? I don't know. Is Walmart going to change the way they do business because of makers? Almost certainly not. But will we start to see an impact? Yeah, I think I feel good in saying I agree with him on that.
Interesting. I don't know. I don't know what to think about this. I like this idea, but although I think the maker movement will continue to grow, I don't know if it's enough to force retail hand, especially since for now these machines, these bots, this movement, it's not making things that are really durable or really usable. They're making things that have the promise of being really durable and really usable. I'm not sure if I'm a go for within 1 year. But let's set the terms on this particular wager here. What do we use as our watermark for whether or not this prediction has succeeded? I'm not really sure. Chibert, what do you think?
How about we say the first large corporation within a year that starts making accessory designs available for 3D printers?
Okay, I got that. What do you think? Is that okay with you, Curtis?
I'll buy that. I think that's a very good hallmark. I can buy that one without any trouble.
All right, Chibert, I'm going to let you drive this. Set the terms and then ask for the nay or yay.
Okay, so within the next year, we're going to start seeing a large manufacturer, not a small one, a large one, LG, Samsung, Ford, Chrysler, BMW, someone like that, a large one that would be considered easily Fortune 1000, will start making 3D designs available for customizing or modifying or fixing, you know, accessories on their devices.
You're obviously thinking yes, all right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I say yes.
Curtis?
Padre?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, you get to call it. So mine is, I want to say yes. I don't think so. I think I love what you've done. I think it's going to happen. I mean, someone eventually is going to do it, and all the others are going to follow. I don't think it's going to happen in the next year.
So that sounds like a no.
It's a no.
Curtis, what do you say?
I'm going to go with a yes. And the interesting thing is, for it to happen within the year, it basically means that it has to have started. Somebody in a lab is working on it now. And I think that's true. And I think it will probably be a very niche little thing. I think it will have a high advertising value. But I do think that it will happen.
Wow.
Within the year.
Okay. Well, I like that. Actually, we've gone from being pessimist to being optimist. I like that. See, that's the magic of Twiet. Let's go over to you, Curtis. You've got a medium-term prediction for us. Lay it on us.
Well, my first one is one that, and I'll be honest, this is one that I heard about a lot when I went to the Gartner Symposium back in October. Autonomous systems are going to increase their presence in enterprise life in some significant ways. Now, we're hearing a lot about autonomous systems, especially in terms of automobiles, autonomous cars driving themselves with us just as passengers. That's certainly not within a 12-month time frame. But I think we are going to see significant increase in the number of factory automation, manufacturing facility, mining or other resource extraction applications where autonomous systems are being used instead of putting human beings in harm's way. The corollary of this is that I don't think it's going to stay just out in the field. I think we're going to start to see decision support being automated. In one instance, we can talk about program trading, but the techniques and the principles behind things like program trading are going to move into more mainstream business applications. We're going to see autonomous systems making significant decisions for the enterprise in situations where we're not depending on a microsecond by microsecond response time.
I like this. Okay, so to clear this up, to me, people who didn't quite understand what the prediction is here, we're not just saying there's going to be more use of automated systems, because of course we're going to see far more automated systems in the future. What you're saying is that same sort of logic that goes behind those microtransaction, microsecond financial systems, we're going to start seeing in devices that actually do things in the real world, right?
That's right. And to put it another way, this is something, the difference between an automated system and an autonomous system is that an automated system will reliably do precisely what you have programmed it to do over and over and over again. Most assembly line work is an automated system. Autonomous systems have the ability to make decisions based on their environment, whether that is a manufacturing facility, minerals extraction, or some sort of business situation in the back office. They're actually making decisions rather than simply repeating programmed steps over and over and over again.
Okay, this is getting interesting. Chibert, you've just heard from Curtis the Terminator Franklin about the rise of Skynet. Do you follow this prediction?
Yes, I do. I personally am starting to see people go beyond the traditional fuzzy logic. You know, we've got fuzzy logic rice pots, for God's sakes. But I think autonomous systems, what we're starting to see for things, yeah, there you go. What we're starting to see self-driving cars and things like that. I think we're going to start seeing toolkits become available. And I think that's what's going to be on the back end in the cloud, because right now, this type of autonomy takes a lot of computing power. And for now, I think that's going to stay in the cloud, but I think it's going to start being applied to everyday things. And so I give it a big thumbs up.
Wow. I don't want to give this a thumbs up because I almost want to make another prediction here. It scares the pants off of me that if we have these autonomous systems, like, for example, let's say I know there are a few vendors that have semi-autonomous defense systems for their networks, that they will automatically respond and change the network configuration in trying to reduce the effects of an attack. But what happens if you start having autonomous systems that are interacting with each other across a network, especially if they're financial autonomous systems? I think this, wow, I just scared the pants off of myself. You know what? You know, Curtis, I'm thumbs up. I think within a year, we're going to see these autonomous systems just fully take over. I think it's actually going to start in the financial markets. And I'm going to go one step further. I'm going to say these autonomous systems are going to become popular, and we're going to see one major screw up of autonomous systems interacting with one another. Can we make that modification?
Oh, sure. I think that a significant screw-up is almost inevitable, in the same way that if you remember the flash crash in the stock market, mm-hmm. that was one where the program trading, once you tipped over a certain point, the programs just fed on themselves and drove share prices down over 1,000 points in a matter of minutes. We've seen the reverse happen on Amazon, where competitors will watch one another's prices and try to come in slightly higher than their competitors. There was a famous case of a book that went from about $9 to well over $1,000 in a weekend because two vendors were watching one another. One of them raised their price a couple of cents. The other had an automated system that did it. They ping-ponged back and forth, and it ran away. It's going to happen in other situations, and boy, will the mass media be all over it.
All right, Cheever, get ready with the pen. Okay, how about this? Can we agree on this for the wager? We will see the rise of autonomous systems outside of the financial market, because we know that this is already happening in the financial market. And we will see one major real-world screw-up of the interaction of one of two or more autonomous systems. Can we use that as a wager?
Yeah, I want to see the self-driving cars get into a who's going first to the intersection.
Okay, all right. So I'm giving it a thumbs up, Chibert.
Yeah, I give it a thumbs up.
Curtis,
you're good.
Okay, we just became pessimists again. So the technology was going to save us. Now it's going to destroy us. All right, let me do my midterm pick before we run out of time too quickly here. The one I want to use is what I'm calling the great unplug. I say within the year, so before 2015, we're going to see several large enterprises start isolating their chunks of the network. We've talked about this before, fragmentation, but I want to go one step further. They're actually going to strip functionality from their machines, like we're seeing them start to do at Google and Apple, to the point where they realize there's no reason for 90% of our employees to be on the internet. There's no reason for 90% of our employees to have unfettered access to everything they have at home. It's almost going to be the reverse of BYOD. Rather than bringing that functionality into the office, they're going to say, we only want to give you the resources and the access you need to do what we want you to do. And we're doing that because anything else is a huge security risk. I say it's going to start with one of, let me get real specific here. It's going to start with a Fortune 100 company that's doing business outside of the tech sector. Chibert, what do you think? Would we ever see this? Would we see a company that says, look, you don't need the internet, just use our network, done?
Sucker bet. It's happening already.
Oh, why'd you have to do that? Dude, I was going to look brilliant for a second.
It's already happening. The military has been doing it like crazy. A lot of places, navies are no longer allowing their ships to connect to shore networks.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. So if we're going to make this a wager, we need to go even further. Curtis, what do you think we can add to this to actually make it interesting?
That's a good question. I think that what we need to say is basically that, and I'll cut you some slack. Let's go with a Fortune 1000 company. So a large enterprise is going to publicly make this a corporate-wide policy. And I'll even throw part of the sucker bet. It can't be Google. They're already making steps in that direction. Can't be Google. I'm glad that you removed the financial industry because, frankly, they're already – going with their own networks. And we've talked about that before. I mean, while it's being done for speed reasons, the fact is that part of that speed means that they are taking out security and other protocols because they don't need them. It's their own bloody network. We're going to see other companies, I suspect, we're going to start seeing large healthcare organizations first. But I think we can go with a large company doing it publicly and making it an organization-wide mandate. How about those three things?
I like that. Okay, Tiber, can we agree with that? Because I don't think that that exists, right? Large company, corporate right, a corporate-wide mandate, and what was the third one?
The second one, actually. Large company, corporate-wide mandate, and, public.
And public, right, public, making it public. So, in other words, a company that that believes in it so much that they think that the business world is going to be impressed by the fact that they're making this a policy.
Yeah, I agree. And I agree with Curtis. I think it's going to be healthcare.
Healthcare, okay. But, okay, so it's midterm, so it means it has to happen before 2015. Of course, I'm going with thumbs up. Tiber?
Thumbs up.
Curtis?
Yeah, based on some conversations that I've had, I'll say thumbs up as well.
Okay, we got three thumbs up. Now let's get to the fun one, the long term. Now this is a bit of a fun one because we're going past the year. Long term means we don't know when it's going to happen, but these are predictions for what is actually going to happen. I started first, Tiber went second, and Franklin, you get to start this time. What is your long term pick?
You know, I was looking at my options, and here's the one that I'm going to go with to try to keep this on a positive note. I have a couple of negative options, but I'm going to go to positive. I think we're going to see a significant change in the way that enterprises do their corporate staffing and certification. You know, we've been stuck on application or system-based expertise and certification for a long time. I think we're going to start moving more to a functional emphasis where people are hired, trained, and certified in financial systems, in CRM, in HR, in big data. I think that we're going to see that transition away from specific application and specific system emphasis to a functional emphasis in the enterprise.
Interesting. So it's a reversal of the trend to specialize. You're saying we're gonna get pulled back from that a little bit?
I really do. And again, I will admit, I'm basing this on some conversations I've had around the industry. People are starting to recognize that what they truly need are some very well-trained generalists. In the same way that companies have embraced virtualization, because it lets them optimize the use of hardware resources. Having people who are generalists rather than specialists allows them to optimize the use of human resources. You know, if some new project comes in, if a new technology comes in, you can much more easily move a generalist to that project than you can getting new specialists. So companies are looking to essentially virtualize their IT expertise in the same way that they virtualized their servers, their networks, their storage, and now their clients.
I'm actually quite fascinated in that pick. Tiber, what Curtis is talking about here is the reversal of a trend that we've seen, especially in IT, where you find that thing that you're good at, you train for it, and then you tell people, this is what I do. If you hire me, I will do this, I will do nothing else. What Curtis is talking about is sort of the return of the geek in the 80s, just that guy, you do tech, right? You're smart enough to know how this interacts with that, and therefore you know at least enough about everything to make intelligent decisions about the system. That's not something we're training for, is it?
No, it's not. And the lack of having generalists available in the corporation is actually a really frightening thing. When you start going back to the original universities, say back in the time of Marco Polo and so forth, the universities trained generalists because you had to know a little bit about everything. We got very specialized, and now we've got people saying, oh, it's just not my job. I happen to be a generalist. I think generalists are more efficient. In fact, the General Services Administration Office of Information Security thought so much of a generalist that they made me senior computer scientist so that I could be sent just about anywhere to go and fix screw-ups. I think corporations are going to start seeing the same thing. So, Curtis, big thumbs up.
And actually, it looks like the chat room agrees with you. We've got Scott H. who says, lack of generalists usually leads to outsourcing. I think this is something that maybe IT people see more clearer for the trees, because we actually have to work in it. When you have a staff who can only do a very limited number of things, even though if they can do it well, it's sometimes very easy to waste resources because you don't have that particular task available, or because you don't have someone watching the shop telling them where they need to spend those resources. Curtis, that's spot on. We're not going to vote on these because there's no time frame, but Keen, the three of us agree that this sounds like I'd actually like this to happen.
Yeah, I definitely would. You know, it's that whole thing. You know, if someone only knows how to use a hammer, they're going to use a hammer for everything.
If you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah.
Curtis?
No question. Like I said, I've been talking to CIOs, and this is something a number of them are saying. So I think that it will take – this is a long term, because it's going to take a while, because there are a number of companies out there, especially in the education and certification spaces, who have a vested interest in continuing to train people for, well, what they already have programs for. But it is going to change, and the enterprise is going to drive that change.
Nice. Chibert, let's go to your long term. And you've got one that I kind of like. Break it down for us.
Okay. I think cloud desktops are going to become the norm. And the traditional desktop computer is going to fade away, except for very specialized situations like laboratories, high-end computing, and things like that. Thin clients are going to become much more normal. In fact, if we cut to that URL that I have in there, Dell is going to be shipping probably this month a new product from their Weiss division, the Wise Guys. And this is called Ophelia. And Ophelia is going to be a $50 HDMI plug that you just plug into any HDMI monitor, and it will turn it into a full thin client. It's going to be really cool. It's going to change the industry. And we're going to start seeing things that are very much going to look like mainframes. And when you can go and take something like Ophelia and stick it into, say, a 60-inch TV in a boardroom, it's going to be the executives that are going to be driving a lot of this move to thin client, because they're going to love to be able to go and start something off on their desktop at home, you know, be able to go and hit the ISP and say, hey, I want a managed desktop. I don't want to have to maintain a machine at home. I'm going to run things there, and then I'm going to jump to the office, and I'm going to be able to log in, and that simulation is still running, or that spreadsheet is still sitting there on desktop, and then I can move over to the boardroom. I like the idea. Managed desktops, I think, are something that's going to be coming. It's going to be very, very – the workstation is going to become cloudy. So that's what I'm predicting in the long term. The workstation is going to become very cloudy.
I like this because it goes back to the very first few episodes we ever did of Twiat, where we were talking about VDI. And VDI had a lot of promise back there, and it's sort of been building, but I think the buzz has dropped off a little bit. You know, everything that we talked about in the short and midterm predictions, when you talk about moving away from – public cloud, when you talk about building up your own resources, it does still seem to be pushing us towards VDI. What do you think, Curtis? Is this prediction, this long-term prediction, that the desktop and the personal device is ultimately not going to matter because your services are stored someplace else? Does that sound to make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely, because it solves so many problems. And I'll admit, when I was in Austin, I did hear a lot about Ophelia. And I'll tell you another area where Ophelia is going to solve a bunch of problems. We've mentioned before, healthcare. Doctors are horrible about doing things properly when it comes to security. But imagine if each physician's personal desktop were on a thumb drive. They walk into a room, shove it into the side of a flat screen that's on the wall, and they have their own system. That's the one that they're going to love, because at that point, they keep it with them. Maybe this is a place where we do see some sort of biometric. It takes their thumbprint as they're putting it in. They're up and running. They don't have to remember lots of stuff. They will eat this up. Dell is huge in healthcare, so they're going to be pushing it in that direction. I think that Gebert is absolutely spot on with this one.
Yeah, I like it. All right. Well, let me do mine, and then we can call it a year. The thing that I see in the longer term is, it actually touches on a story we covered not too long ago, and that is the death of perimeter security. I think it's inevitable that we're going to get to a point where we realize there is no longer that green zone. You can't say we're going to defend our network at this point, and then once you pass that point, you can do whatever you want. What we've seen from advanced persistent threats that Raphael Mudge has shown us, what we've seen from attacks that have been taking place within compromised networks that allow for BYOD policies, what we've seen even from networks that have some sort of backdoor built into their encryption, is that you can no longer assume that any connected device is safe. You have to assume that anything that's connected to anything else will be at one point or another owned. No matter how much it's updated, no matter how secure you think it is, no matter what kind of policies you establish. My long-term prediction is we're going to move to a model of trust no one. But that's easy. That's easy. I could say, yeah, we're going to trust no one. I think it's going to go one step further. We're going to move to a model of trust no one, but yet that has yet been made easy, especially for enterprise executives and enterprise professionals to use. So it's going to be a transparent trust no one. It's going to be one of these developments, one of these technology companies that is going to produce a solution that removes the protection at the perimeter, moves it inside the network, and instead has very rigorous authentication between devices and between resources, always just assuming that it's going to be attacked and always looking for the most rigorous form of authentication that it can before it grants resources. I like this prediction because I think it ties in with what both of you have been saying about the future of networking, especially with VDI. If you have a VDI model, it would seem that this sort of authentication would be perfect for someone who's moving a device from the office to the home to maybe a remote branch. Gebert, what do you think? Do you think we're going to see the end of perimeter security?
I don't want to say yes. I think it's going to be a shade of gray. I think it's going to be a very long time before perimeter security completely goes away. But yeah, I do agree. The traditional definition of perimeter security is going to shrink. And I think VDI is going to be doing the shrinking.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's going to be a natural shrink point. People are going to say, wait a minute, if I'm doing VDI anyways, why do I need to protect a perimeter? There is no perimeter. The perimeter is me. What about that, Curtis? Do you think that could be sold to executives? Because the problem that we've always brought up anytime we talk about doing more rigorous authentication within a network is it only takes one manager, one executive who bypasses security because they don't want to be bothered to do X with their password or their authentication, and suddenly the entire model falls apart. But if we do move to VDI, I think you could get this sort of centrally resourced, centrally located, centrally managed resource that can be rigorously authenticated without much cumbersome effort on the part of the user.
Well, I absolutely agree with your prediction about what's going to happen. I do believe that we're going to see the perimeter, if not go away, certainly lose its importance. I think that there are a lot of companies that will keep perimeter protection in place primarily to ward off lawyers, because as long as they keep that firewall in place, they can say, well, we're doing everything possible to try and keep the bad guys out. So it'll stay there, but again, primarily to ward off lawyers. I'm not sure that the authentication is the critical piece of what's left, though. I think what we're going to really see is the rise of some very fast, very intelligent heuristic-based systems that watch the activity of every node on the network. And when something happens that breaks pattern, when something happens that includes a signature, when something happens that looks off in any way, they're going to take that node, coordinate off, shut it down, alert the staff, and begin immediate mitigation. I think that very rapid detection and mediation is going to be a part that's just as important as anything that goes on in the authentication arena.
Well, Twyatt Riot, there you have it. Those are our predictions for 2014 and beyond. It's actually nice to get to this point where we can say we've been going a full year and now we're in this mode where, yeah, let's predict the future. We're going to come back to this episode in 2015 and we're going to see how close we were. And I'm going to go one step further. I've got a couple of the Twyatt Riot who are working on a little survey that will allow you to place your votes for who was right, who was wrong, and who's buying the pizza. Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being here. As always, you know how much I appreciate having you as my co-host. The show wouldn't be possible without you. Chiebert, tell me what's going on. Where can they find you? What are you doing in the new year?
I am ADVNETLAB at Twitter. I don't think I'm going to be changing the Twitter handle only because the guy that actually does own Chiebert might actually let me have Chiebert. I don't know. I'm still trying to get a hold of him. But some things are happening that are pretty neat. I do want to give a shout out to some of the guys that did Waze, W-A-Z-E. It's a nice little app that allows you to go and give other drivers in your area a heads up about accidents, cops, speed traps, slowdowns, and so forth. And it dynamically collects driving data so that the Google Maps or navigation maps and so forth are much more accurate. I think this is going to be a killer app. And I think I've already installed it on my devices and I'm going to participate as a Wazer. Wazer. Whatever.
Whoa. Okay, so Chiebert, down with the ways. What about you, Curtis? What's going on at Enterprise Efficiency? What wonderful things will you be doing in the new year?
Well, I've been looking at some new ways to tell the stories of the CIO, and we're going to be bringing those out. We're going to be looking at CIOs, senior IT executives, IT from the strategic standpoint, and I think I've got some very interesting ways to tell some new stories. So I'm hoping that folks will come by later on in the month of January, see these new ways. Let me know what they think. You can always follow me on Twitter. You can see my handle down there. I'm also on Google+. Look me up. I'm a nice guy. Don't bite. So reach out and touch me with any kind of stories you have. Love to tell the stories of the people who make IT happen around the world.
Make IT happen. I like that. That's actually a good tag for him. And I will see the both of you after CES when I get back and hopefully not come down with the con funk. I want to thank both of you, but I also want to thank you. That's right, you. You're our listener, the person who downloads our podcast or who watches it live. You spend an hour each week listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 100% of the doges that are currently in the brick house. And you know what? We want to do something special for you. We want to thank you by giving you a way to download all the goodness about the latest hotness automatically into your device of choice. If you go to our show page at twit.tv/Twyatt, you'll find all the different ways that you can get This Week in Enterprise Tech automatically on your iPad, your iPhone, your Android device, your PC, your laptop, whatever it might be, up to your zombie Zune. We want to make it easy for you to hear the latest and greatest about what's going on in the enterprise. Also, did you know that we've got a YouTube page? Yeah, if you go to youtube.com/Twyatt, you'll find all of our episodes and the individual segments. You remember those things that we did? The Stuff My IT Guy Says, the 101 series of courses, Pro Gear, Pro Tip. Find them there if you want to learn up a little bit about what's going on in enterprise tech. Also, you can follow us here live every Monday at the Brick House by going to live.twit.tv. We do tape at noon, and if you come a little bit early and stay a little bit late, you get to see the pre-show and the post-show and all the bloopers that go in between. And believe me, we do make mistakes. Like right now, this is a mistake that Brian's going to cut out in editing just because I want him to have to do something during editing. It's all part of the experiment that's Twit. As long as you're here for the live show, why not drop into our chat room at irc.twit.tv? There you'll be able to talk to some of the funniest trolls, some of the brightest engineers, and yes, an occasional Twit head. Or two. Finally, I want to thank you for following me on Twitter at PadreSJ and for finding us here at the Brick House in Petaluma. Thanks to everyone who made this show possible, especially to Lisa, to Leo, to my super TD, who is normally Jason, but today is Brian Burnett, and also to Carson Bondi. I want to say thank you. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.